Profit to Profit. I'm Scott Margolin.
And I'm Brian Califano.
And we're here to help you find solutions to your most persistent, aggravating, and costly business problems.
Each week, we feature a co-host drawn from the ranks of the country's most influential and powerful business leaders. Together, we dig into your questions. Our co-host gives you their advice, and then we make sure the dollars and cents make sense.
So let's get started.
Our co-host for today's podcast is Nina Kaufman. Because having a business isn't about making good money. That's a lesson that small business champion and entrepreneurial.com legal expert Nina Kaufman learned the hard way. She's no ordinary business attorney. Forbes magazine calls her one of the top 25 most influential women tweeting about entrepreneurship. The U.S. Small Business Administration named her their regional Women in Business Champion of the Year. As a trusted thought leader, she reaches over 2 million readers each month on entrepreneur.com. She's also a Met fan by marriage and former stand-up comic. And as we're taping this, congratulations to the Mets, by the way.
So yeah. Woo! Yeah. Our team.
I have to throw that in there.
Yeah. We'll see what happens.
We'll see. We've already seen what happens. Let's not interrupt Nina. Let's not be rude to Nina. Yeah. But we've already seen what happens. That's right.
Well, she did say Mets fan by marriage.
It's okay. So. We'll take any and all. Anyway, I'm sorry. To her dismay, Nina found out that the business she spent over 10 years pouring her heart, soul, and savings into wasn't worth a dime when she was ready to move on. The moral of the story, it's all about creating freedom, having options, and building a life. She has a particular passion for showing owners of service businesses how to build, grow, and sell their companies by getting them to function without you. You can get a free copy of her special report on 10 Steps to $1 Million Business at businessexponential.com/pod report. Nina, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the show. Glad to be here.
So Nina, what is it about entrepreneurs that made you pursue that in your legal career instead of going with like a typical big legal firm working as a general counsel in one of a top Fortune 50 companies? I mean, to do that kind of business, it's a challenge, right? So what was it that attracted you to that line of business?
Well, I'll tell you, when I started my business in the mid-90s, there were a couple of things going on. First is that there was the beginning of that explosion in entrepreneurship in the mid-90s, mid to late 90s. And one of the things I saw having my own business, and it was a boutique firm, is that I really didn't think it was going to be useful for me to knock on the door of IBM and major corporations and say, "Hi, I'm a small firm. Don't you want to use me?" Rather, I said, "Who's not being served? Who doesn't already have those relationships cemented?" So that there actually is an opportunity to cultivate that connection. And that's how I sort of fell into entrepreneurship. And I have really, really loved it. Just love the people I'm working with. Optimistic, positive, but they got their feet on the ground as well.
So in our intro, we talked about you saying, you know, to really bring out the freedom. Are you talking about freedom to work with people you want, freedom to do what you want, when you want, freedom to work the hours you want? What exactly is it about the business that you're leading today that makes it the freedom so much attractive to you?
Well, I think it's all of the above. You know, life is short. And when you spend it, as so many people do, toiling away in back offices and cubicles, and the lawyers that I know who are working for larger firms, and they're miserable. And for what? So that you spend 12 hours a day just to earn a salary to get some possessions, and then maybe you sort of enjoy them around age 65 and then you die. I mean,
the so-called golden years, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that to me is not leading an intentional life. So having gone on this path of entrepreneurship, there is a lot of freedom in being able to say, this is who I am, this is what I stand for, and this is how my business reflects those values.
You know, there should be an office space type movie that's just around law firms. I've just heard so much around big law and how different it is than doing something like what you're doing. You know, it's very different. You talked about, you know, languishing in the cubicles of a huge company or something like that. I mean, it's much more empowering. You know, it's the line of communication between you and a small business is very direct, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if really it's when you think about big law, it's like the big faceless corporations that we kind of grew up with, the gray ladies on Wall Street, as they were. So in many ways, big law does become that way because it is hierarchical. It's very structured, and there isn't often an opportunity for the kind of upward movement that anyone with ambition would like to have. And that's one of the things I saw. It's one of the reasons I started my business, is that I wasn't seeing women make partner at the litigation firms where I was working. We weren't being trained from within to really get the bigger trial experience. They were hiring laterally, and they didn't want you developing your own book of business. So I didn't want to be, you know, 10, 15 years out, and they say, you know, bye-bye, Nina. We can get someone who does your work cheaper.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So now that you're in this line of business now, so in your line of work, like, what you obviously deal with a lot of entrepreneurs and small business owners. You know, what are some of the two or three things that entrepreneurs commonly do wrong, or missteps that they do during their early stages or during periods of heavy growth that you've noted that that you can potentially head them, you know, for our listeners who are listening to this, who may not even engaged in a lawyer or may not have a good one like yourself. What are the top two or three pitfalls or obstacles that they encounter only?
Right. And first, I just want to thank for that little plug about my being a really good lawyer. So thank you for that.
No worries. There's too few of them.
I would say one of the things that they do that doesn't necessarily serve their long-term goals is that a lot of business owners get started because, sort of as I did, my boss was an idiot. And that's why they start their business, because they're passionate and they're really good at what they do. But they're tired of working for the man, or they're tired of getting passed over for opportunities. So they want that ability to get the opportunity, but they haven't realized that doing what they do well is very different from running a business that provides their product or service. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the first things is not understanding that important distinction, and sometimes not getting the education or the support around what does it mean to truly build a business, because they are two different skill sets, mm-hmm. doing what you do and building the business. And it can be very difficult for business owners to make that leap from working, as Michael Gerber in the E-Myth says, working in your business, mm-hmm. to having that CEO leader mindset to work on the business.
For small businesses, it's a much bigger burden, quite frankly, sure. to, you know, hire an attorney. Typically, they'll hire an attorney out of necessity, not out of added value. So how do you, you know, move past that and drive the value to a smaller business?
That's a great question. And one of the ways that you drive the value, unfortunately, can be hiring out of necessity and seeing, wow, what did it cost me to clean up that mess that I stepped into with both feet? And if you're working with some, or just a question they can ask is to say, okay, how do I not make this boneheaded mistake another time? Just like anything else you would do, whether it's dealing with a customer or using a particular supplier, if it doesn't work out the first time, you don't need to repeat it. So asking that attorney, all right, what can we do? What will we do differently? If I came to you fresh, and this is the question to ask, if I came to you fresh, what would it be? And you see what kind of response you get from that person, that attorney, and whether or not they are the kind of attorney that will want to work with you proactively, or whether they are just going to want to run the meter when things get difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's definitely something that we encounter with every, you know, with a lot, too many lawyers out there, is that, you know, you run the meter and the what is it, the 12th minutes, or it divided 1/6 of an hour, so 10 minutes or whatever, you always have a 20
right, 10th of an hour.
Mm-hmm. This very slow talking lawyer, you know.
And then, you know, you don't want to pick up the phone.
Yeah. Exactly.
And you're like, you know what, I'm going to go on LegalZoom and I'm going to get some of this information myself. And I'm afraid to call my attorney. I mean, that's a bad place to be, right?
It is a bad place to be, because also if you go into LegalZoom, it's like my performing surgery on myself, or my doing my own taxes. Yeah. You know, can I muddle through and maybe kind of do it okay, and maybe it'll work out? Well, maybe. And is there the potential that I could really muck this up to a fairly well? Absolutely. Because right. You're not trained in it. You don't know what should be in a document that's not in there. You may not know how to evaluate what is there that might not work for you. Right. So that's where having those trained eyes and talk, you know, having that honest conversation around money. What kind of, you know, what does this cost me?
Right.
Well, I guess we have similar conversations with our clients as well. And people normally, what Scott and I do, we don't necessarily have competition versus just figuring out does it fit in their budget. That's really what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. I mean, lawyers are a little bit different. It's you almost, you know, you need good lawyers to come in and set you up the right way early on. And if you have intellectual property, that's usually the first person you'll call right away. But you know, the key thing is that you get the right lawyer, right? So what questions, like when you get a new client or when you start exploring whether or not you should be going with somebody, what kind of questions would you ask the person to determine if they're the right person for you to
engage? How do you qualify them, right?
How do you qualify
them? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. All good questions. I would say, first of all, one of the things that I... Now, are you asking me if I were a client, what would I be asking a lawyer, or what do I mean?
Okay,
the other way around.
Because you're selective as to who you want to work with, also, right?
So I am. So one of the things that I look for is the client in that knowledge economy area that I work with? So marketing, training, consulting, communications. Do they, you know, is their business in the area of expertise that I have, or are they? I don't know. I hate to say manufacturing widgets because that's such a lawyer thing, but are they manufacturing cosmetics? Are they a restaurant,
right,
for example?
Sure.
Because there are some definite curlicues to restaurants. One thing I learned years ago, early on in my practice, was I represented and I'm doing air quotes here, small business owner. Who he owned a number of residential properties, and that was his business. Well, I gotta tell you, landlord-tenant court is like going down the rabbit hole. And if you don't do that regularly, because there are practices and procedures and ways of dealing with it, boy, did I burn myself terribly because I took it on thinking, ooh, he's a small business owner, but really wasn't in an area that I knew well or, quite frankly, liked.
Right, right.
Going back to that issue of freedom. So certainly first thing for me is, what industry is this client in? And are they asking about things that I have the capacity to serve? So if someone's an inventor and they need patent help, that's not me. I'll refer them to somebody who does that.
I mean, it's also hard for you, I guess, because I think one of the interesting things about what you do is you will also work on a fixed fee.
Yes.
As we do. And so qualifying is super important because, you know, you don't know what kind of rabbit hole you're going to go down, right?
Exactly. And that's also talking to people about, well, what are their, where are they in their business? What are their business plans? What kind of budget do they have? Are they just starting? Have they already been operating? And you get a sense from those answers, as I'm sure you do when you're screening clients, the vaguer they are or the bigger the promises are, you know, they really haven't given a lot of thought to it, or maybe they're trying to please you in some way with their answer. Yeah. And that's usually not going to be a good fit. It's the people who are very clear and just say, hey, this is who I am. This is where I am. This is what I can afford. And if we, you know, if we can't work together, that's fine. Let them be and work with people who can serve them at their price point. Right. It doesn't have to be me.
If it looks like a duck, it's probably me.
I want to shift a little gears here a little bit, going from qualifying a client to talking about entrepreneurs and small businesses and talking about their exit strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Which for many clients, when you talk to them, sometimes they look at you, what do you mean? What am I planning on doing when I leave? I am planning on working this, you know, this company forever.
Yep.
But there are the large majority of people who are thinking about this smallly are thinking about what's my next step beyond this. And they are what I would call a serial entrepreneur. What should entrepreneurs be, if they're not thinking about their exit strategy, what should they be thinking about? And, you know, are there steps legally that you think they should think about during the early stage of their company or during their formative years that they should do now to avoid problems later on?
Yeah, I think a great question for them is what kind of life do they want to be leading? In the sense of, do you want to take vacations? Do you have young children? Do you have older parents? All of those things are going to require time away from the office. And do you want to take that kind of time unplugged? I mean, let's face it, there are some people who are workaholics and are very happy to use their business as an excuse for why they can't be with their family.
Correct.
That's a different psychological issue requiring a different professional set of skill sets.
Neither CFOs nor lawyers should do that.
Exactly.
Psychoanalysis, right?
Right. So for the ones who say, oh, I'm going to be in this business forever, well, you know, I can predict, I can claim gloom and doom. For example, one of the guests on my podcast, Phil Clements, so sad, brilliant attorney and accountant, and had created this wonderful consulting firm working with small businesses. Vibrant man, owned a plane, owned a yacht, and he died flying his plane. He was flying at night, and the next thing we heard, the plane had crashed in the woods just outside of an airstrip near where he lived.
Wow.
Who knew? Who knew? So, you know, you can get hit by a bus, you can suddenly become disabled. Those events are too remote. But what's very, very today, very present for a lot of business owners is, are you up until 3 o'clock in the morning, four nights a week, because you're trying to get stuff done? Are you losing sleep? And if so, you're not ready to think about selling, but how can you start to think about pulling yourself back and bringing other people into your business in some way? Whether it's better automating some of the processes you have, maybe hiring more people, hiring differently or using a virtual team differently, thinking about your pricing structure. You know, are you doing one single projects after another, or do you have a continuity stream that you can rely on? All of those things involve both legal and strategic issues that can move business owners along the road to actually having something that maybe they could sell.
Nina, we're at the part of the show now, the heart of the show, I should say, where we take two questions per episode from outside parties through our email, Twitter feed, etc. It's small business owners that ask a pressing business question that's been on their mind. You're going to analyze the problem based on your experience, give advice, potential solutions, and Scott and I are going to pick it apart and see if it's feasible on a financial level and see if we can help this address the questions. So, Scott. Right.
So here we go. This question comes from Susan Jones of ReadySetStartup.com. You can find her on Twitter at Ready, Set, Startup. Susan says, people don't know what they don't know, so they aren't able to get help in their weaknesses. As an entrepreneur in consulting, how do you point out to your clients where they need help? How do you show their weaknesses without damaging your business relationship? Should you just report the facts? So Nina, what's your take on that?
That's a great question. I would say maybe part of my screening process is that I am fortunate to work with people who have sought me out because they realize they don't know everything and they are willing to listen to direction. So when we're sharing these suggestions, it's not coming across as a, wow, you really stink as a business owner. How could you not know this? It's, you know what? I want you to have the best business possible. And these are some of the things that I'm seeing that could help improve. So I think there are two things going on there. The first is that, and asking for a business owner to ask him or herself, are you receptive to others' feedback, or do you think you know everything?
Right.
And the second is the people that you're working with, well, how are they delivering that feedback? Because that could be something too. If you're working with someone, quite frankly, who's really condescending and obnoxious, there are ways of, you know, where they make you feel like, well, you know, what kind of an idiot are you? How did you not know this? And those are not the people you want to surround yourself with, because that's, for the most part, that usually doesn't encourage you to move forward and to be open to those suggestions. And also for business owners to do their own reading and learning and listening, you know, podcasts like this, just the more you do to expose yourself to the world of entrepreneurship in all of its many phases, your own questions are going to come up. Right. And there's going to be more you want to know.
Look, for us, it's similar with the added, I guess the added notion that, you know, when we're stepping through with a client on what their plans are and how are they going to seek out and accomplish what these goals are. And so specifically when we're working on building a strategic plan that they can compare themselves versus their actuals, you know, a lot of times the bits and pieces that are necessary aren't there. So it's not a finger pointing exercise for us. It's really figuring out, let's figure this out together. Why is revenue going to grow 58% next year? You know, well, we grew 58% last year. Well, you know, that's great, but let's break down the details. Let's go through, let's talk about the customers you're going to have next year. Do you know who those are? No, I don't know. And that's how we end up working with startups and younger companies, helping them figure out what they don't know and filling in the pieces. We'd like to create a more actionable plan for them. And again, you know, folks find it helpful because they have more of a roadmap to what they're doing.
Yeah. And I was going to say, just as advisors, to the extent that we're sharing information that's going to speed the process, help them get more revenue, or help them save money, why wouldn't they be open to that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was going to be my only point to Susan is, you know, if you're a consultant and you're worried about your client not wanting to hear what you have to say or being sensitive, then why did they hire you in the first place? Like, what are you bringing to the table? I mean, you know, obviously, Nina, you would be hired to because you have the legal expertise, and I'm coming to you because I'm asking you for help. So I realize that I don't know everything about legal. So, you know, I'm going to take your advice. You know, I may have questions about it, but I'm going to have to take advice. And that would be the same for all business with consulting and, you know, accounting processes and procedures. That's the same idea. I mean, if somebody hired me, I'm not going to be afraid to tell them what I see. You know, if there's something wrong with how they're collecting their receivables or if it's open to certain things, I'm going to tell them. If they disagree with me, well, they can disagree with me and they're the ones that are paying the bills, and that's okay, sure. I guess. Yeah, right. But I'm not going to sit quiet and wonder, oh my God, I don't want to hurt his or her feelings.
And it's something that's happened with law too. There is so much information out there, just as law has become so specialized. So one of the values that she brings to the table is that ability to curate the information, to distill it, to translate it, and to communicate it to this particular client in a way that's going to save them all of the hours and days and weeks that she has spent honing her skill set to be able to bring it to the client. So they don't have to go through that entire education process that she went through. That's the value that she brings, and that's where making those suggestions based on what she's seen, what she's done, what she's experienced with other clients, again, can help them speed that road to profits.
Well, hopefully that wraps it up for Susan. Thanks, Nina, for that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, sure. Yeah. I guess in short, Susan, just don't worry. That's why they're hiring you. Give your thoughts and, you know, good luck.
Be as unvarnished as you've got to be.
Exactly. Exactly. We have another question, Scott.
Yeah, so the next question comes from Nick Cavara of socialpunchmarketing.com. You can also find him on Twitter at ncavara. What is a realistic expectation for a small business to get financing? What qualifiers are most funders looking for? So this has red meat all over it for, I think, everybody, for us and for you, Nina, also. So So what do you think?
Give up before you start, man.
Yeah. No banks.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, Nina, go ahead. What are your thoughts?
No. I think first, the first and obvious answer is it depends. What is the business and what are you looking for? I mean, you go to Shark Tank, you see a huge range of businesses and opportunities that are there.
Yeah.
One of the similarities that comes up, investors are looking for how are they going to get a really solid return on their investment and within what time? And that also means you as the business owner need to be able to let go of some of that control.
Yeah.
So it's really seeing what is the arc of the business? What are the opportunities for you know, merger, for sale, whatever it is down the line, because the investors are going to make their money on the exit, not just handing you a pile of cash and saying, oh, sure, I'll hang out with you for the next 25 years. Not what they're interested in.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think the biggest thing about, and again, he doesn't say what stage he's at, but like we were joking, like Scott was joking before you answered, was, you know, no banks, no banks. And the reason why we're saying that is because we have a lot of customers who engage us within their first 2 years of their business. And banks aren't even, you know, that's like that when you talk about qualifying a client or a potential client, the first thing they ask is, how long have you been in business? And if they hear less than 24 months, they just say, thank you for your time. And they won't even consider anything. So if Nick is a person 2 years or less, I would say probably not going to happen through conventional means, which doesn't mean that you can't find it, but you're going to have to consider, you know, friends and family first. I mean, that's really the most common thing that you'll find. I mean, unless you have a wealth of money or you have a big savings or a trust account sitting on the sidelines, which the large majority of us don't, you know, you're going to have to dip into your pockets initially. You're going to have to finance yourself. I mean, you're going to have to really buy in yourself, because nobody's going to invest in you unless you've gone either all in or invest, you know, shown a financial investment in yourself.
And I think, you know, again, it was a good clarifying point, Brian, on that where they're at in terms of years is that, you know, in the first couple of years, it's really hard. You know, no bank's going to look at you if you're less than 2 years worth of financials. You know, we know plenty of folks that will lend under 2 years. And you know, merchant financing's out there, but it's really, really cost heavy. And my advice would be to try to bootstrap it along as much as you can and hone your product, at least for the first couple of years, and try to eke it by. And for those that are at later stage, you know, there are financing options available. And then from the investment side, as you said, Nina, you know, is it going to make a return? What is the wow factor of this business that's going to excite somebody? You know, is it a passion play, or, you know, is this a real opportunity? You know, there's investors on both sides of those coins. So it for private investment money, you know, that's something you can pursue after the 2 year or so mark, probably more reasonably if you had some operating history. You know, if you're a pure startup and this is day one, it's going to be tough. Friends and family, unless you have like a killer product, it's going to be tough.
Yeah. And hey, Nina, how many times have you heard somebody come up to you and, you know, when you talk about giving up ownership and say, I don't want to give up 10% of my company. This thing is going to fly like an eagle in about 6 months.
I like to say that those kinds of deals aren't worth the toilet paper they're written on, because they're not. You know, and Scott, to your point, the question is, what do you need the money for? Do you need it to get started? And if so, you know, having clarity around, well, do you really need it, or is it more important to bootstrap your proof of concept, and then the money that you get from an investor can help roll it out and scale it further.
Yeah, and so, there's a lot of ego involved, you know, in building a business and getting financing unto itself. And it's important to separate your business and your own ego from that and really work on your business model and your product, because the money is going to come. So if you're really hone that and craft that idea for the first couple of years and you eke it along and prove the concept out to the market, the money's going to come. Especially if you've survived 2 years, it's definitely going to come. And look, you got to reach out to folks like Nina Kaufman's firm. I mean, getting set up correctly out the gate is a hell of a lot cheaper than it is to correct things later on. So if you chose your wrong corporate type, so you're an LLC or whatever, and then you want to convert that, and you want to go for your Series A and then convert to a C later, it's going to be expensive, right?
And more complicated.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. You know, and someone said, begin with the end in mind. Right. So that's where you want to have some sense of, well, where do you want to take the company? And is it the kind of company, the kind of business where you will want to seek some kind of outside financing? Because, yes, that's where the legal and the structural issues do come into play. And raising money, or even just getting it from friends and family just to throw money at the problem is not going to solve the problem.
And this all goes back to something you said earlier, Nina, which is, you know, how do you want to exit? How do you want to get out of here?
Yeah.
And that would be that's a qualifier, I think, unto itself, is that any funder is going to ask that. They want to know how they're going to get their money back. They want to know how they're going to exit. And when. And how.
And when, absolutely. Sure. Because, as I say, they're not going to sit around for a quarter of a century while you're enjoying your business.
Right.
If that's perfectly fine. If you have the kind of business that you want it to provide you and your family with a good income, mm-hmm. and then cash it out when you're kind of ready to move on, that's perfectly fine. But that's often not the kind of business that investors are eager to be part of.
So Nick, we gave you a far-reaching and kind of multiple scenarios, answers on your financing. Hopefully you fit into one of those buckets.
Yeah, as I said, this was red meat all over it. So
right, but which actually brings me up, you know, I know we're coming up towards the end of our time together, but I do feel the need to ask this personal question to you, Nina.
Uh-oh.
So one thing I noticed on your website is you have this product, and your website, by the way, for our listeners is askthebusinesslawyer.com, which I strongly recommend that you go on to. Because I was looking on there, you know, researching our discussion today, and I noticed that you have something on there called the Entrepreneurial's Prenup, or Prenuptial.
Entrepreneur's Prenup, that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like a very serious document, and it's probably, so if I had a partner, and we'll call him Sam, how do I prevent him from screwing me over? And and how important is a prenuptial at the start of a business?
Isn't a postnup more important than a prenup?
No, you need a postnup when you don't have a prenup. Well,
all right, great. So are either of you married?
Yeah.
We're both married. Not to each other. There's anything wrong with that.
Okay. and did either of you have prenups before you got married?
No.
No prenups. I was too young and foolish. Okay. And trustworthy.
Young and foolish and trusting. Yeah. And you know, and that very often happens with business owners, that they are just as wide-eyed about starting a business with someone else as very often people are about marriage. But there are some ways to screen. And in a personal relationship context, we kind of take these things for granted. But within a business context, there are some really important questions to be asking. And the Entrepreneur's Prenup, which is essentially a study guide as well as pointers toward what should be in your prenup, your business prenup, it takes you through. Are you really compatible on your goals? Do you have the same attitudes toward money? What are the roles that you're going to play in the business? So many of these things business owners don't think about, and then it ends up being a disastrous situation because they're assuming that you're just going to be working shoulder to shoulder instead of seeing how does this all fit within the context of a larger business. So that's one of the ways that the Entrepreneur's Prenup came in. And when you think about, well, how do I make sure my partner doesn't screw me? Well, first of all, are you dealing with someone you can trust? Right. How do you know? Have you run a credit check?
Right.
And people say, oh, well, I couldn't do that on my business partner. Why not?
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
business. Why wouldn't you? You know, why wouldn't you be and want to be as transparent as possible when you're both putting money into a business?
It's almost sure. like an M&A deal, right? So if you think about it that way,
yes.
So if you're gonna acquire a company, like, you know, whatever, with a significant dollars, why wouldn't you do it from day one, right?
Absolutely. And because a very dear friend of mine says, when emotions are high, intelligence is low. So when you're in the middle of a crisis with your business partner, your intelligence is going to be really, really low because you're each either going to be at each other's throats, or you're going to want out, or the other one's a pig, or whatever the situation is. You're not going to be thinking clearly. When you're at the earlier stage and you're just starting, it's why I think a prenup can be better than a postnup.
Right.
You're both in a frame of mind where you say, okay, what's fair? And you're able to discuss that and reach those agreements at a time when things were fair, instead of, wow, I want to be at your throat.
And then look, the altruistic view is, like in any marriage, like in my own, you try to work it out, but it's not always easy, right?
Mm-hmm. No, it's not always easy. And also it's something, maybe not quite so much with a marriage, but you want to reevaluate over time, because you do have the option to leave a business and say, is this still working for me? Am I earning the money that I thought I would or wanted to?
Right.
Absolutely. And only that, I mean, for Scott and I, we had several, interesting conversations where, what happens on the business if somebody passes away, or what happens when, if we become disabled? I mean, those are not easy questions.
Early conversations.
Yeah. No, but right we had away. To have them. I mean, the non-emotional or Nina's yeah, sure. Very highly intelligent. I don't know how intelligent our conversations are, but we did have those types of conversations because, you hear too many stories of, if somebody gets incapacitated or if somebody goes, if you can't work for a period of time, how do you make money, right? So these are all questions that you have to say in the outset, out front. Like any good marriage, you should have those conversations. In a business, I would say it's as important, if not more important, because this is the livelihood that you bring to your family. So it impacts both.
Right. And obviously, and God forbid anything should happen to the business partner, do you really want to be in business with their spouse? usually the answer is no.
Right. I know. I love my wife, but I don't think Scott wants to be in business with her. Trust me.
Yeah.
It's a losing proposition. So, Nina, we're coming up to the end of our time. Before you go, though, I want to give you a chance to, if our listeners have any follow-up questions, they want to reach you directly, how can they best reach you?
Yeah, best way to reach me is through my website, askthebusinesslawyer.com. If you go onto the contact page, there's a form there. Just plug in your name and email and your question, and would be delighted to be in touch. As you mentioned in the introduction, one of the things that I tend to focus on is how can businesses that are already up and running find ways for the owners to step back just a little bit and enjoy their lives as they are building and hopefully growing and then selling their businesses. So so there's a my separate website, businessexponential.com/podreport. There's also a free download on 10 Steps to $1 Million Business.
Well, Nina, thanks so much for being on the show. It was great talk.
Thank you for the opportunity. Great to be here.
Yeah, awesome. So with that, we're going to say farewell, and we are the Profit to Profit.
Thank you for listening, and keep smiling.